It's not about reincarnation.
Yeah.
It's the same spirit or whatever, the same soul or whatever. He wants it again.
There are various views of this which can be resolved only by referring to very abstract principles of mathematics. We can deal with it in a relatively simplified way, first of all by defining what the word soul means. Now, we marked out a zone of sentient power with a circle. Because we've got a circle around it, it is permissible for us to say this is solo. It is one on its own because it's encapsulated. So if by soul we mean a zone of sentient power, then we can say that that soul could reincarnate into many different situations. And then we would have to draw around the soul various other circles to represent material situations in which that soul has been and which have formally conditioned it. Now, supposing I drew one circle to represent a soul and I didn't put anything inside it, and I drew another circle away here and another and so on, but I drew nothing inside them, they would be souls of no character. Right? But if I strike upon one of these souls with the energy from outside and produce waveforms, energy inputs, to which that soul, being itself energy, reacts, then we have a condition in which the soul becomes characterized by experience. We could then say that wherever there is a zoned off portion of sentient power, power that feels itself, there is a soul, and wherever there is a recognizable structure within it, which is its own response system to stimuli received, then we would have a soul that would be able to cognize itself if it were able to assemble the same pattern that it had before. Let's take an example, supposing a man who's been brought up to think of himself in a certain way because his parents have given him a name, we'll say it's Trevor Smith. And he's got used to listening and responding to this name. And then supposing I persuade my friend Herbie to beat him on the back of the head with a club without warning him, and he becomes unconscious with the blow, and afterwards when he regains awareness, his awareness is impaired and he cannot remember his name. Now, does he know who he is? He is a zone of sentience, but he has now no name. He cannot recall his name. This occurs quite often in road crashes where people have concussion and they don't remember who they are, they don't remember where they live, and mysteriously they don't even remember that they're married. Which is very strange. I have a friend, a very funny fellow, who went on a holiday on one occasion. I shan't tell you from where, because you'd immediately recognize him. He was a gentleman of the cloth, very revered, spiritually minded fellow. He went on a holiday for some unknown reason to Bristol, probably because of Cockney writing slang. And while he was there, he forgot that he was a minister of the gospel and married at home. And he stayed with some people who had a beautiful daughter. And in his forgetfulness, he married that daughter. And as a result of some strangeness about his behaviour and his rather excessive age, he's about my age, the parents became suspicious and made inquiries and found out, lo, he was a gentleman of the cloth and he was actually married with a living wife. And he landed in court and he tried a psychological defence. Namely, I forgot I was married. But it happened in the relatively small community where he was, all the people who were concerned with his trial were remarkably ignorant of modern psychology, and they just thought he was lying. So he went to jail, you see. But he could have been telling the truth. The fact that he wasn't is really irrelevant, because there are there are plenty of cases where men really do forget, you know. Some of you may even have been walking downstairs and forgotten it and missed a step and fallen. Has that ever happened? You can do that. You can actually forget. Now, if you forget any of your characterizing structures, can it be said that you are the same soul? And does it matter if you are, if you can't remember it? Supposing you have a sphere of perfectly sentient power that knows nothing whatever. And supposing it's one of those strange creatures, usually born in the sand and the ram, that are totally ineducable. Because they will not be imposed upon by anything. And so, you put them inside a physical body, and they go through the world, and they are battered by people's suggestions, right and left, and they are taught morality, ethics, philosophy, politics, everything they are taught, and as fast as they are taught, it vanishes. And then they die, and they go through the Bardo, and on the other side, they still don't know anything, and they don't know who they are. Now, what kind of valid incarnation is that? One into which you enter in total innocence, go through it unscathed, and arrive back in the next world with no more knowledge than you had when you entered. Can that happen? The answer is yes, it can, it does. Not necessarily, no, because you can remain unscathed eternally, can't you, that way? What's uneconomic about it? You disagree with the whole structure in which you find yourself? So perhaps you don't go and get a job because you disbelieve in being imposed upon. But you do believe that you have a right, an inherent right to survive. So you survive because there's some peculiar people in the world that can't bear people not surviving. So they help you to survive, don't they? You might have heard of a thing called the welfare state. It's a kind of device for taking care of people like that. And probably many of you with cars have given lifts to strange boys called dropouts and so on, who are going to celebrate the summer solstice on Salisbury, playing with guitars, dwelling in Indian teepees. They have no money and no job, but they're all horribly well fed. And they've got a stack of LPs under their hand. And they're actually surviving. So why isn't it economic? There are cases of men who find that on social security they get more money actually than they would get if they gave it up and got a job. Oh yes, it is. Very, because they're learning more and more and more about how to dodge more and more and more. They become terribly wise. You see, you have to be very careful. When you're talking about economy, you're talking about good household management. Aren't you? That's what the word means. It's relating to managing the household. Supposing the household is the whole world, and you only manage it in order to survive, don't you? Supposing you survive with least energy expenditure, that could be called very good economy. And the only reason you would like to acquire knowledge is in order to be economic. But if you can be economic with no knowledge, so that's even more economic. This is called the romantic approach to existence, as opposed to the classical. In the classical approach, you logically do everything you're supposed to do. In the romantic approach, you misread everything on purpose, and thus retain your freedom. If you really believe what you're saying about economy, Goethe, it suggests a certain amount of conditioning in your early youth towards social conformity, doesn't it? Yes, I will forgive you. We would like you to rethink it rather more carefully. Yeah?
If you came in with this innocence and it's out of scale, would it not be necessary for you to come back and learn a little bit? Or could you be fine to come in with it?
Well, necessary means never ceasing.
Yeah.
Nothing is necessary except that which never ceases. Yes? Now the only never ceaser is absolute energy. That never ceases. But the forms of its expression are always ceasing. Like good Buddhism would tell you, they are phenomenal forms. They arise, they persist for a little, and then they vanish again. They are not necessary. They arise, they persist a little, and they vanish again. Now this question of reincarnation is really this. Has a given zone of sentient power, in this case a human being, has he sufficient formal reflexive self-knowledge to be able to identify himself if he does reincarnate? Because reincarnation without reflexive self-awareness of the fact is useless. Because according to reincarnation theory, we have all been reincarnated innumerable times in the past. But of what avail is that if we don't know when and where, and what lessons we learned, if any, and we keep doing the same stupid things over and over again, and not learning the lesson? Why don't we learn it? Because of non-reflexivity. It isn't enough to be a soul, you have to be a structured soul. The ancient Greeks thought that the soul, if you like to put THUM, it's a nice Greek word, this level, you call it thum, the thumetic nature, primordial tum, is an appetival drive, and that reincarnates and reincarnates. But is it truly a structured self? Not unless you have that power to create and then preserve that which you create. Because if you are not capable of structuring yourself by thought, by assessments, by judgments, and recording those assessments in such a way that you can recognize them, is your reincarnation any good? You could have been a toad or a leopard or a nice fellow or anything millions of times, but it avails you nothing unless you are reflexive. You have to know that you are you. Otherwise reincarnation is meaningless. In the doctrine of anatta, the non-self, the Buddhistic view, is that there is no permanent, separate self away from phenomena and looking at the world of appearances. But there is an arising of an apparent self, namely a structure within the zone of sentience, and this structure is your apparent self for the time being. But if somebody comes along, suppose you say, I'm such a person, I believe in certain things, like I have my friend Gerhardt, who is always prepared to accept a role if I ask him to play it, for the sake of the development of us all. And I say to Gerhardt, would you mind assisting me in a little experiment and say, is Gerhardt the name that your parents gave you? Have you identified with it in a different way from the way that you did with the other name that you had? You have. So you've actually got a different structure of ideas around the name Gerhardt to that which you had around the other name. And which one would you rather take with you if you were to reincarnate? Yeah, you see. Now here we are, a soul which is undoubtedly simply a zone of sentient power. When I first knew him, he was named otherwise, and his behavior was otherwise than it now is. Now he has a new name and a new structure of being, and he prefers the structure of being that he has personally chosen to the one imposed upon him by his parents and educators. Now, which is the real soul? What does the word real mean? Certainly it is a non-different soul, if by soul we mean sentient power, but the structure within it is totally different. And it is this structure that he's saving. He has a better structure of ideas deliberately put into him that he prefers to the ideas previously imposed upon him by social pressures. And with the new structure that he makes, then, by recognizing that at death and gathering it together into a unity, He can take it with him through the baldo, through the intermediary state, into the state between death and rebirth, and he can carry on with his development of his idea there, and in that state of deliberate self-conscious development, he can bring himself to a point where he chooses, not accidentally on a pleasure-pain basis, but deliberately and rationally, another order of life, consistent with the follow-up of the one he's already chosen as Gaya. So what does reincarnation mean? Every soul is energy and all energy is eternal. What it really means is, have you got a reflexive structure that you can recognize and say, this structure I willingly affirm? Now, I'll tie this up with the other question that I was asked to deal with about women and doing. I assume the question means, what relation is there between an active, deliberate, free-willed act and the way that women normally respond? Now, the Greeks had an idea about woman that when she came to die, she did not die as a man dies. When a man dies, he is aware that he is dying. You know, when Achilles is dying or Hercules is dying, they know they are dying, and they know they are great heroes, and they hang on as far as they can to their integrity at death. And they hope that by hanging on to their integrity, a formal, structured definition created by themselves, by their own deliberate intent to be a certain kind of being, that they will survive the process of going through the baldo, survive the period between death and rebirth, and they will emerge again. You know the title of King Arthur, the once and future king. When he dies consciously for a cause, and he gathers himself together at the point before death, so that he does not disintegrate at death. So in the days of knight errantry, when two knights fought, and one was about to put the knife or the spear or the lance into the other one who had been defeated, he always paused and said, would you mind making your peace with God before you go? This is gentlemanly behavior. And you gave him a few minutes, and when the fellow said, right, I have now collected together, stab. And the man was collected. Now this is not rubbish, it isn't myth. All the energy of your being, if you can gather it together at death and define yourself as you will to be, that definition strongly impressed upon this soul consciousness will persist between death and rebirth, so that you can be reborn again as you, the once and future king. The Arthur that died is then the same Arthur that lives again, because he bothered to define himself. And that was the rule for the great male heroes. But how did the ladies fare according to the ancient Greeks? Well, they volatilized. That is to say, they had conceived themselves in a certain way as mothers of the race and charming little dollies for gentlemen heroes to play with. And when they had come to a certain age, they said, well, I'm not worth playing with now, so I'll give up. They did not bother to structure their consciousness. They let go of it. So that the energy that had been gathered together in them simply dissipated in space. And there was not then a soul. There was just energy translating through infinite space. So being a recognizable soul in all the great religions is hard work. It's a very, very strong doctrine. When Christ says you can lose your soul, what does he mean? He means in identification. You know, in extreme cases of schizophrenia, you have a soul of a human being, but there are so many diverse formal structures which are not compatible that instead of having one personality there, you may have several. And they may actually dominate. Like a psychiatrist said recently in a lecture, that one of his patients was so much at war with himself that he was actually thrown by forces from one part of his body through the air, whilst another part of his body was fighting not to do this. And that he went through the air and landed on his back, hurled by forces in his own body, over which he had no control. Now, at death, what happens to a disintegrated person? Does he suddenly become integrated? It is inconceivable. So, all the great religions and all the great philosophies too, which say Plato is the type, and Plato is still read by intelligent people, because of the basic synthesis that he made of all the religions of the ancient world. If you read Plato, you're not reading Greek philosophy only. You are reading Egyptian philosophy, Asiatic philosophy, Hindu philosophy, Persian philosophy. Pythagoras himself greatly influenced Plato. And Pythagoras spent a lot of time in Egypt, in the temples then from the priests. And if you examine the Platonic theory of reincarnation, it shows its roots in Hindu theories of reincarnation. But the whole problem of reincarnation is simply this. Can you design for yourself a structure that you can guarantee will not volatilize at death, will not fly away like a vapor, but you have defined it in such a way that its inherent coherences resist disintegration? Now, in the New Testament, the disintegration that takes place in your idea body after the death of your physical body is called the second death. And if you understand the meaning of the expression, Christ is my anchor, or if you understood the real meaning of the body of Buddha, the diamond body, it's exactly the same concept. You have a body that is so structured with pure logic that it cannot disintegrate, and you are then technically an immortal. Even if you are actually in a physical body on earth, you could become an immortal. That is to say, if somebody blew your physical body to pieces, your idea body would not fall to pieces. You are still there, and you are capable of assimilating all that has happened to you, including the IRA bomb, and you can choose for yourself to reincarnate, if necessary, immediately in some available baby, and go back and sort them out. That depends on structure. One must get structure. Now, women have, for millions of years, dedicated themselves to child rearing, and all that is implicit in that is to say, in focus on the physical body, and on the bringing up and nourishing of other beings. And when those other beings have grown up, and that woman has decided to have no more children, and it is a decision when you enter the climacteric, it isn't a thing that happens automatically. A woman could persist in childbearing all her life if she so decided, but usually she gives it up. She thinks she's done enough of that, and she goes on into nothingness. And there is a natural tendency for a woman to think, I will not structure myself, I will nourish the child, and I will bring the child up, and I will look upon that external child, and as the child grows, that is good enough for me. I have done my best, and I can afford to let go of myself and dissipate absolutely. Now, the question was, what is the relation between woman and doing? Horrible noise will now reappear. Here is the head of man, here is the chest, and here is the tummy. Now, if you read this Hebraic, that is from the right to the left, that's Ad, and this is Am. Adam. That means the total human being. The Ma, down here, the Am, the Ma, means appetizable power that does nothing except take in and grow, take in and grow. And when it reaches a certain point of tumescence, it delivers what it has taken in downwards in the form of a child. That is the material principle, the principle of matter, and the principle of motherhood. And it conceives itself as a volitional sacrifice for the future, which is why it says in the book of Genesis, the seed of the woman shall bruise the head of the serpent. Not the seed of the man, the seed of the woman. The evolution of the human race, you please remember said diagram, the evolution of the human race depends upon the sacrificial act of woman. Because we cannot evolve a soul, we cannot structure the soul unless we incarnate the soul in a body. And we cannot do it except in a human body. It must be human. And therefore we have to put souls into human bodies in the only way we can, that is through human bodies. And it's a highly specialized job to be the recipient of a soul and the nourisher of a soul and the educator of a soul in its beginnings when it has no self-defense power, no security. Therefore, there has been for millions of years this marked tendency in woman, which is divinely appointed instinct, to devote herself to the children and to look upon the growing child, the developing child, the intelligent child, the child consuming money for its education, the child going to the university, the child become a man making marvelous inventions, the child on the moon, the child in outer space. And for this she has sacrificed her own soul. She hasn't bothered to integrate herself. She's used all her power for the integration of another being. And through this other being, through her nurturing of that other being, and through providing the education for that other being, and constraining some man or other, the Tao part, which means to give, to constrain that part to provide the means of education. So evolution is furthered, and the children, by generation and generation, gradually become more and more and more complex, more and more structured, and moving towards reflexivity, until someday the human race as a whole will be entirely reflexive. It will be sold. S-O-U-L-D, S-O-L-D, to the cause. It will be solid, it will be solo, it will be a genuine soul brought through evolutionary forces determined by Infinite Spirit to the point of perfect self-determination. At the expense of woman. Now we're in a very funny position, we're halfway out of the pond. In our historical day, we see that lots of young men are becoming slightly effeminate. And lots of girls are having to make decisions. We are in a barrio, a transition point. And we know we are moving towards Aquarius, which is the age of the computer. And we know that after 2,000 years of Aquarius, we'll be in Capricorn. And we know that in Capricorn, the whole human race will be aware of its own self-reflexive self-determination. It will actually be a divinely conscious being. Everybody will be aware of what it means. Like today, most people are only half aware. But in every period, there are a few, statistically about 5%, of people who are dedicated now to self-acceleration. There are women today who are prepared to learn about their own structure. There are people today who feel naturally a little ambiguous. They have children, but they think they also have rights themselves. Perhaps to do something intelligent. And not just mind the baby. You're the help in for the baby. Look after the baby and look after the help and keep the eye on the help so that it doesn't get the eye on the husband and so on. All these things are structuralizing experiences. And there is a definite mood in woman today towards self-structuralizing. But there is also a tremendous inertia of childbearing and nurturing and self-sacrifice in woman that makes her feel that maybe she shouldn't do this. Maybe it's wrong to want to be a person. Maybe it's wrong to want to escape the bondage of repetitive reading of next year's genius. And there is a great conflict, and the conflict is here. Ma, in the Tam, primordial appetite, which yet and yet until it filled itself and then burst out in a new creation, the child. And upstairs here is Da. Now Da means analytical power. It means division. And it means to give. Ma is an appetite that receives, and Da is an intent to give. You see that in the nature of the sperm and the ovum. The ovum is waiting to receive. The sperm is rushing to give. Da means to give. basis of that word donate. It is more blessed to give than to receive, said the ancients, because the receiver, receiving the energy in which true message builds up inside the being and then bursts forth in another generation, has been tricked by nature into looking after the child at its own expense. A necessary trick of evolution, but not a trick that need go on forever. And we are in a barrier, a transition state. It is possible for women today not to volatilize. And it's not only in women's lib, but in the soul of woman at large. In the last 2,000 years, there have been so many women mystics who have begun to get hold of this idea, and so many women who have striven to get hold of it, that there have actually been cases where women have rescued themselves from the merely matriarchal functions and have begun to define themselves not only as receivers and deliverers of children for the next generation, sacrificial figures, but they have also the power to define their own role from within. Now, the biological function, you know, occurs in the animal world. All the female animals, they have children following penetration, following giving by a male. And they have these children and their lives are dedicated to the children. And they remain in that state. And in the animal world, they do not strive to get out of it. So that the aspect of merely breeding is said to be an animal function by the biologists. But in the world today, amongst women, there is a real tendency to want to know what it's all about. And what is the real role of woman? Is she merely a child bearer? Now, once upon a time, the command by God was, be fruitful, fill the earth, and subdue it. That was okay when there was a little small group of mutant beings, the first human beings. But now, with 800 million Chinese in the world, and roughly the same amount of Indians and Pakistanis, and roughly the same amount of whites, and roughly the same amount of blacks, there are so many people in the world, we could say that the part of God's plan, be fruitful and fill the earth, has been accomplished. So we enter into the next phase, and subdue it. Now, your physical body is your personal earth, and it is full of impulses. It has to be subdued, that is led underneath the dominance, the controlling will. One must learn to structure oneself from within. And how do you structure yourself? By choosing. Every choice that you make changes your metabolism. Every choice you make in changing your metabolism has changed the structure of your physical body and your emotional body, and your body of ideas. So in the act of choosing, instead of merely passively accepting a choice made for you from outside, in that act of choosing, you are structuralizing your soul. And then if every time you choose, you deliberately choose that which endures forever, the necessary choice, as the philosopher would call it, when you choose of necessity, because you need must love the highest when you see it, when you see it and you choose that which necessarily structures you permanently for eternal endurance, then you have freedom. And then you are no more, in the old sense, merely a woman. You fulfill the words that Christ said when a disciple said to him, all this salvation for men, what are you going to do about women? And he said, turn them into men. He didn't mean simply alter the pattern of their genitalia. He meant to say, alter one thing in them. Turn them into self-structuralizing beings who do not look merely to their children's performance in the university to justify their existence and then die volatilized, but who are prepared to educate themselves as well as the children into truth by self-examination, by self-postulation, by self-positing, by designing your own being deliberately and consciously instead of suffering the imposition of another being from outside. And it's an either-or. Either we are passive to the forces acting upon us from outside, from the universe at large, from human societies, some governments, from educational colleges and so on, or we say, no, I am going to design from within the kind of being that I will to be in all eternity. And then you sit down at the drawing board and you design yourself a being worth being for all eternity. And when you design that being, it will fit together like a geometrical structure. That's why I said it was a problem, this incarnation and reincarnation problem, really, for higher mathematics. Because in fact, you are dealing with mathematical, logical, geometrical structures when you are designing your own being. You have a head up here, and you have a chest, and you have a tummy, you have two legs walking about, and two arms, and sense organs. They are deployed in space, are they not? They are geometrical structures, and they are mathematically analyzable, and they are logically positable. The triplicity of geometry, of mathematics and logic, deliberately designed by a self-conscious reflexive soul in such a way that no power whatever in all eternity can destroy it. And then it says simply, they shall not be hurt of the second death. When your physical body is struck dead by a blow or a war or poison or whatever, it cannot strike your self-defined innermost structure of the soul. Then you can choose whether to incarnate or not, when and where and for what purpose, because you are a totally self-defining being. And strictly, only when you are such are you fit for human consumption. I'm making a reference there to the Eucharist. When Christ says, this is my body, this is my blood, if you do not partake of this body and blood, you shall not enter into the kingdom. What does he mean? His body is cosmic structure. His blood is the life force flowing through that body. Now, if you partake of the willing, positive impulse of life, could you go wrong? And if you dedicate that life flow to the structure of cosmic truth, can you go wrong? No. But if you do both of those, then you are within benefit of the Eucharist. And it required a man, self-dedicated in that way, with divinity within the innermost center, self-realized, to lay down his life, to say, right, now here it is, here's the demonstration, this is what you do, this is the handbook of self-realization. And then get on with the work. Do the work, then you will know whether they are of God. Then the woman who has been passive for millions of years to childbearing and the postponing of her own development for the sake of the children takes up her own development and becomes in her own right to the good of our ministers, Yasha Heifetz, which I have yet to see. But it is conceivable that somebody can do it. And if we remember the girl, Jacqueline Dupre, on the cello, we know it can be done. Because there was a girl who, before her illness, showed all the potentiality of that kind of dedication. So here we are in the middle of a bardo, a transitory period in history now, when they're climbing Mount Everest in China and making a Chinese film, and they're showing ladies climbing Everest too, which shows that the biologists that say women are not as good as men are not necessarily telling the truth. Some women who have not dedicated themselves to childbearing and self-sacrifice have dedicated their being to self-development for the benefit of the collective, for the benefit of the totality of the universe. Now that is a sensible way of looking at reincarnation, isn't it? Because it shows you that the Buddhistic idea that there is no real self to incarnate is a statement made about human beings who have actually no permanent reference. And what Buddha was asking them to give up was an impermanent, silly, stupid reference made out of the accumulations of impulses to pleasure. The thirst for pleasure, the trishna, the tamha that gets you into existence, this is the trap, he said, and give it up. But in his day, when he was asked certain kinds of questions about the soul and its persistence or not persistence, he replied, instead of saying, you are not yet fit to debate that question, this is not an edifying question. Because the question in those days was wrongly set. But the question today is very, very well set. That every woman, when she listens to those woman libbers who are reacting in the wrong way, that is in a protest, and cursing male chauvinistic piggery with female chauvinistic piggery, to not to waste energy in protesting, but to use all that same energy in positive self-definition of what one wishes to be eternally. And it's a very simple test. All you have to say to yourself is, whatever character you already have, would you like to be stuck with it as it is for all eternity? Now, if you can actually look at yourself, whatever you've got, and say, yes, I would like to have this in all eternity, and you're absolutely sincere, well then, keep it. But can you look in front of the mirror at yourself and say, I've got blue-grey eyes, or brown eyes, or black eyes, or whatever, and these I will eternally. And what do you think about yourself if you did that? Would you have a very high opinion of yourself? If you stood, as I've actually seen a man do this, before a mirror, I must confess it was in a toilet in town, and he was drunk. And he looked in the mirror like this, and he said, I'm wizard. Worthy of eternity. Now, can you do that with anything you've got? Have you got something going to an end? Would you like it for all eternity? Have you got an aquiline nose or a snub nose? Would you like it for all eternity? Or has it got nothing to do with external phenomena, but something else? Stand in front of the mirror and look at yourself and say, this I will for all eternity. I will to be absolutely self-responsible, so that I, in being self-responsible, can dedicate myself to a cause, should one appear, worthy of such a self-dedicated person. Now, it doesn't matter what colour you are, what race, what creed, whether your knees are fat or slim. If you have that kind of dedication, you can guarantee a structured soul, reflexive, able to persist beyond the grave, able to determine its own re-entry into the time process whenever the time process should require his presence. Yes, madam.
Why there is so much energy in the erroneous structure?
For
example,
why there is so much energy in defense and in different kinds of defense? Well, it's quite simple. You see, when the first turn in produces a soul, that soul has no inner structure. It is very loose. And this ties up with Andrew's point about the sense of touch, about the sense of resistance. It is very loose, it is not sure of itself. And when an external stimulus strikes on the periphery of that thing and shakes it, in the shock, it contracts on itself. It tries to seize itself to maintain its own being.
Is this a conception?
Well, actually it starts in the love play before the actual conception. That is to say, the way the father and mother are feeling and thinking and willing about each other, it is their energies that fuse together to provide a biomagnetic field into which that consciousness can insert itself. But you can see there the whole value, the shock that comes from outside to this closure, which is a bit protoplasmically wobbly, when the shock comes, then you find you tend to pull yourself together. You can all do that experiment, just suddenly without warning, push somebody to right or left of yourself. Yeah? And what happens to the pushed person? Does the pushed person at the moment of the push become more self-aware? Yes? And this is why God has permitted a gentleman called the devil to exist. And say the absolute intelligence has said, we've got to have a shock giver, an accuser. You know, accuse means to strike at. Somebody who comes along in the middle of your complacency and says, you pie-faced loon. And then you go to the mirror to see, yes, you look at me. My word, he was right. I have a pie face. You know? It's this forcing into deflection that does it. Tremendous value in shock. The crucifixion of Christ was a great shock. The poisoning of Buddha was a shock. Many, many great sages have been done to death, quite deliberately. They come to the end of a certain life and they say, now, what can I do for you before I go? And that is get a friend to do something horrible to give you a shock. Like Gandhi being shot. Gandhi was much better shot than dying of cancer or something else, slowly. The shock value is the game. Excuse please, you are sentient power. Yeah? You are sentient. When the shock comes, the sentience receives the shock in a certain way because it is sentient. And although it may not leap into full immediate flowered consciousness, it is sentiently aware that it has received a shock. And it decides in one of two ways. It can decide, why did I bother to get in this condition of shockableness? By having a skin and dissolve the skin and go back. That's going to nirvana. You go to a heavenly eternal bliss that way, and it's okay if that's the choice, you go to bliss. But some others are the more persistent types. When the shock comes, they don't say, vote to skin out of existence, but, very interesting. Let me recover a bit and then give me another. Then gradually they get cheekier and cheekier, and they say, don't warn me when you're going to shock me next time. So you can actually do what I do. Have you any idea where I sleep? Mm-hmm. Every night. On the edge of the bed. On the edge of the bed. In Bardo. You know why? You could fall out. So the slightest move and you could crash onto the floor. Now, it actually helps sentience. Try it. And when I was a small boy, it was very, very politic to sleep on the edge of the bed because I had two brothers. And if you weren't on the edge of the bed and in the darkness of the night you heard feet coming, if you didn't immediately roll off the bed and under it, you were drowned with a bucket of water. You see, there is such a thing as giving oneself shocks. That's very kind to other people. You give yourself the shock and they can't fall out with you, you see. Because ordinary people, when they get shocked by another person, say, I'm shocked, you shouldn't have done it. Now you're my enemy. This way you shock you. And you are your friend. And nobody else can shock you as efficiently or as quickly as you can. So your friend is everybody, because you're your own shocker. Shockade. And that's the meaning of hell. When your defences have piled up and up and up so much, then in your identification with defence, you can't think about anything except defence. You are said to be in hell. But then the Logos of God, the supreme reason of God, embodied in Christ, comes along and says to you, because remember, you can't go in the innermost centre of your being. that is not defending itself, and that is the Logos inside you. And that one will invade you, it will enter your hell. And it will tap on you and say, look here, you're hiding and you are defending yourself and you don't need to. I'm giving you another chance, tap, tap. Oh, yeah. Now imagine what it's like. Jacob Berman on one occasion went into a mountain where he found a couple of spirits of robbers who had done a burglary some time ago, and in fear of being caught, they ran away and hid in a cave and died. But the souls were still hiding, frightened to come out. The bodies had died, but the souls were still in this cave hiding. And then Jacob Berman had a problem. How can I persuade them that they are really dead and they feel alive? Now Swedenborg had the same problem, you know. He was a very good clairvoyant, and as a seer he went into the next world, and he on occasion found things like ministers of the gospel sitting around coffee tables debating the higher reaches of theology. And although he himself was absolutely confident that he had the supreme truth, when he sat down to debate it, he was not able to persuade those deceased ministers of the gospel that he was right. What did that mean? Only one thing to me, that Swedenborg wasn't as strong as he thought he was. Now, nobody is stronger than the Logos, than the center, the innermost center of being, so nobody can stand against that center. And when you have been in hell long enough, and when that center decides to operate, it will operate whether you like it or not. It will break your identification, and it will release you from the bondage of the fantasies that have been imposed on yourself by yourself.
In the same life.
In the same life. Yes. Yes. You don't have to be imposed on in one life just because it's one life. You know, like, I was born such and such, I have a white skin, and consequently I'm under the curse of the great white chief. I must behave like a fiend to all coloured peoples. I must destroy them because I am white, you know. I am Nordic, and therefore horrible. You don't have to be, you know. Somewhere hidden in your depths, there is a soul with no marks on it whatever, other than those it wills to put on it. The original tabula rasa of the scholastics, the blank sheet on which you have written, on which you have, believe it or not, an ink eraser. And you can rub out all the definitions of yourself that you've ever made and make new definitions. And when you do that, you can reincarnate as many times as you like into the same body. Because you know you do reincarnate every morning when you wake up. And you don't have to wake up every morning with the same rotten habits. You can actually design for yourself before you go to sleep the kind of work that you would like to do while you're asleep to make yourself wake up a different person. Person means through sounding, it means structure. A soul has a personality. And the personality is the way the logic of that soul is structured. So you can actually design for yourself a personality worth having, through which the energy of this soul will sound into action in the world. There but for the grace of God go I. There's an amusing little bit of a film I saw last night about Ray Charles, who is a blind Negro singer, and a little boy who'd been blind for some reason or other, having been introduced to Ray Charles, when his mother wanted him to go for an operation to cure his blindness with a high degree of possible success, he said, no, Mummy, I'm not going to be able to see. I refuse the operation. I want to be like Ray Charles and sing. Now, if you think about the depth meaning of that, it means that whatever succeeds is called good. Like not being able to see is good. if it provokes you to work in such a way that you wouldn't have worked if you could see. And then along comes a child, as usual, and with his superb logic says, I only want success. And here is a fellow singing, Hit the Road, Jack, and getting millions for it. Why shouldn't I go by and hit the road, Jack? You see, the universe is a structure of will. And all the values so far accepted by the human race imposed upon them by educational structures and by religious structures and by political structures have been so far for the convenience of the imposers. But working behind all temporal, all earthly imposers, there's a supreme imposer, the absolute, who uses those temporal impositions as resistances to provoke you into individuation, to find yourself and to model yourself in any way you decide. But remember, final warning, design for yourself that form which you will affirm in all eternity. And don't waste time on defining anything else. Don't care whether your hair goes up or out or in, but do care whether you are able reflexively to will your own condition, your own thought, your own emotion, your own action. Nietzsche said, eternity, I love thee. He was talking about the same thing. Define by act of will the kind of being that you would will to be in all eternity. You cannot be wrong, because you are so sincere with yourself in your depth. So if I say to you, I ask you to do a little exercise, tell me just one thing that you can in all eternity will to have as a permanent possession, what will it be? Huh?
Love.
Love? Love? Will? Anything else? Intelligence? Integrity? Self-responsibility? Freedom? Are we clever? You see, we all know the answers, don't we? They come welling up from inside. Why? Because we are absolutely, fundamentally rooted in eternal spirit. So we all come to the same conclusions. You know what I think I'll be in all eternity? Top cat. You see? But not jealous of other top cats in their dustbins. I will finish with a little statement which I said earlier to a fellow rather shockingly. This very day, and a man, a very, 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 very famous Zen exponent, when he was an old man, and he said, all my life I have been eating rubbish. Now I excrete it and lay it upon the altar of the Buddha. What did he mean? He meant quite simply that all the stuff that he'd been gathering was intellectual balderdash. Mm-hmm. And that he had discovered that it was only the will to find it that was of any value. So he threw out all the structures that he had imposed upon himself and returned to his essential root will. And then he put his will on the altar to the Buddha, knowing perfectly well that if anybody wanted any rubbish designing, he could do it from previous experience.